Tonight is the night of Magha Puja, the full moon of February, and this is one of the three main festival days of the Buddhist calendar, the three lunar festivals, Visakha Puja in May, full moon of May, which is the celebration of the birth, enlightenment, and final passing away of the Buddha. So that is the day when the Buddha is celebrated, and then Asala Puja, which is the full moon of July, when the Buddha first gave the Dhammacakka Sutta, the turning of the wheel of Dhamma, and that's also the first day of the rains retreat. So that's the Dhamma day, the day when the Dhamma is celebrated. And Magha Puja, which is probably the smallest of the three, is the Sangha day, because this is the occasion, as probably many of you will know, that early on after the Buddha's enlightenment, early in his teaching career, there was a spontaneous gathering of 1,250 enlightened disciples who drew close to the Buddha and met in the Veluvana, the bamboo grove in Rajgir, on this very full moon day of February. And it was also along with that spontaneous gathering, which there was only one of that size that occurred during the lifetime of the Buddha, it was also the first occasion that he gave any kind of instruction on discipline. So it was a special and unique occasion in that way. A year ago, I was just recollecting, I had the very good fortune to be in Rajgir on this very day of Magha Puja, and strangely enough, even less people were gathered in the Veluvana on that day than they were gathered here in this room this evening. But there was three of us. We had our own little puja and recollection. But it was very powerful and wonderful to be there in that physical spot. Now it's something of a garden. They planted a lot more bamboo. Maybe it's the descendants of the original bamboo, but I somehow doubt it. But there's a large pond, a tank, rectangular tank, lotus pond filled with large fishes, the center of the garden, various little shrines and pavilions, and very peaceful and well-tended green space. And it was very lovely to be there and to recollect these events, unique gathering that occurred in the lifetime of the Buddha, and the teachings that he gave on that occasion. So in Thailand, and I think possibly in other Buddhist countries as well, this Magha Puja is particularly observed within monasteries by the disciples of the teacher, who may have scattered to different places, been living in faraway locations. It's an occasion to come together and to pay respects to the teacher. So I think probably the very first Buddhist festival I ever attended was in 1978, the Magha Puja they had at Wat Bapong. And I was very new to the whole business of Buddhism and monastery life, and it was all kind of very strange and different and marvelous. And I was pretty impressed just by an ordinary observance day, a one prayer night at Wat Pananachat, with 30 or 40, maybe 50 of the villagers coming in and joining us for an all-night vigil. That seemed pretty amazing and special. And then I remember I was an anagarika, and Ajahn Prabhakaro took a few of us over to Wat Bapong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, a few miles away, on the Magha Puja night, to taking a substantial proportion of the community to go over and pay respects to Ajahn Chah and to join in with the ceremonies there that evening. And I had no idea what I was going along to, really. It was just, you know, the car is going, 6 o'clock, get in the bus and then arriving there and finding large numbers of monks and nuns, novices gathered together in the hall, and then around and about in the forest. There were so many of the monastics that they couldn't all get in the sala, in the hall, and 2,000 or 3,000 lay people all gathered together, again scattered out through the forest, and this was amazing and extraordinary scene to me. And of course, it was the Dhamma talks were in Thai, and it was all incomprehensible in many ways. But I remember the magic of that night, and particularly the circumambulation, because with so many people, you couldn't just all go around the main building, because the line would be far too long. So they had a track all the way around the central area of the monastery, which is most of the thick jungle, thick forests had been cleared back, and in the central area it was fairly open ground with a few free standing trees and some kutis. So the path for the circumambulation went all the way around this large central area, and with everyone holding candles, flowers, incense in their hands, and in the whole thing completely silent. So after we'd gathered and had the puja, and Lumpo had given a substantial Dhamma talk, and we set out on the circumambulation, and I remember just my heart filled with this extraordinary wonderment. Just what an amazing thing, what a beautiful way to express one's devotion, just walking silently in the dark, just a candle slowly dropping wax over your fingers, and everyone sort of picking their way along and following gently behind each other. And then finally, when we got to the end of the third lap, placing the candles just on little rocks or on branches in the crook of a tree, and the whole forest being sort of filled with these specks of light, these little candle spots of candlelight throughout the forest all around us, and then going into the hall to meditate, or sitting out under the trees. And there's this profound feeling of beauty and devotion. So the Magga Puja is a time to recognize that quality of sangha, of community, and in the way Ajahn Chah has also developed it, particularly as a time for Acharya Puja, not just a celebration of an abstract quality of sangha, but also taking that opportunity to come and visit the teacher and pay respects, and to check in and to express that kind of commitment or connectedness to the teacher. And this kind of gesture, coming with candles and flowers and incense, Ajahn Chah would always encourage people to develop this kind of this way of relating these kind of offerings and these traditions and forms, but he would often emphasize that this is only one kind of puja, like we did this evening, the chanting, the bowing, the offering of candles, flowers, incense, and then the circumambulation that we'll do later this evening. These are all what is known as amisa puja, or external forms of showing reverence, vandana. But there's also another kind of puja that the Buddha spoke of, which is patipati puja, which means the offering of, or the act of devotion in the form of following Dhamma practice. And so that, as Ajahn Chah would often emphasize, you know, we can put a lot of attention onto the external forms of devotion and make grand gestures of offering, you know, putting up buildings and providing splendid Buddha images and, you know, very grand bouquets of flowers or finely woven kind of delicate arrangements. In Thailand they have this whole craft of, you know, woven leaves and threaded flowers and making these extraordinarily kind of intricate, delicate, beautiful floral offerings. So we can put a great deal of attention into the external gestures of devotion, or you know, expressing great eloquent passages of reverence and devotion and respect and admiration for your teacher. But yeah, I think certainly I know from my own experience, and probably everyone here has gathered, it's, you know, it's sometimes an awful lot easier to bow to the Buddha and to revere the Buddha than to actually realize the Buddha mind, to be awake, to actually put the teaching into practice, to wake up, to let go. And that, and sometimes what happens within us is that we actually defer the internal practice by, you know, sort of emphasizing the external. We kind of use it as a way of compensating that, well, we can't really get it together to actually do this stuff, but at least I can, you know, demonstrate to the world that I'm really devoted to the idea of it. And that's not to belittle that. Certainly it's better than spending time in numerous other kinds of distractions and destructive pursuits, going out shooting animals or just burning energy in wasteful, you know, pointless ways. But what our teachers, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Sumedho, would always emphasize, and certainly what I would encourage, is that along with the external forms of puja and celebration and gestures of devotion, that one is matching that with an equally kind of committed and heartful devotion through the practice. Like I often quote the exchange between the Buddha and Ananda just at the time of the Parinibbana, where the Buddha is lying on his deathbed and the Mandarava blossoms are raining down from the skies and all the heavenly musicians are tootling away on their veenas and trumpets, and he has quadrillions of devas and brahmas and crowds of devotees have all gathered around, and there's earthquakes and rainbows and, you know, the whole business. And the sala trees the Buddha is sitting under have burst into bloom out of season in May, and Ananda saying, "This is amazing, this is incredible, you never has the Tathagata been so revered, so honored, so such an extraordinary degree of reverence and devotion being shown to the Tathagata." And the Buddha said, "Yes, it's true, Ananda, but if beings really want to express their devotion, then what they'll do is they'll practice the Eightfold Path." So yeah, cut the flowers and, you know, cool it on the trumpets, just, you know, actually get on your cushion and a little more of that instead. Well, it's interesting that the instruction that the Buddha gave to the 1,250 arahants in the bamboo grove, even though they were fully enlightened beings, in a sense that the discourse is recorded, what's called the Ovada Patimokkha, that we'll recite together later on this evening, just before we have the circumambulation. There's a very essential and practical guidance for that kind of training. If we truly love the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, if that's what inspires us, that's what is close to our heart, then and we wish to enact to embody that devotion, then these simple guidelines, these verses point to how we can do that, the way that we can most effectively bring that devotion, that commitment to fruition. And it's also notable that the very first line, where you get, there's a couple of different recensions of it, but in this version that we have here, the very first line in Pali is Kanti paramang tapo titika nibbanang paramang vadanti buddha, which is translated as patience and endurance are supreme practices for burning up evil. All those who have known say Nibbana is the supreme Dhamma. So, just in that very first line, Kanti paramang tapo titika, patient endurance is the supreme practice. In a way, that's kind of all the advice we really need. Because that, in terms of meditation guidance, if we're trying to train the heart, what a lot of that training is about is turning, being ready to turn towards the karmic results of our actions, the karmic results of birth. The very fact we have a mind, we have a body, means we'll feel pleasure, we'll feel pain, we'll feel neutral. Neutral feelings, will experience praise and criticism, happiness and unhappiness, gain and loss, fame and disrepute. All of this will arrive. We will perceive. We will know all these different qualities of experience. And this simple phrase, Kanti paramang tapo titika. Tapo comes from the word tapas, meaning austerity. So patient endurance it comes from the word kanti, which is a it's not really the English words don't really encompass the full meaning of it, because when we think of patience in English, it's often that kind of gritting of one's teeth. It implies a stoicism, a readiness to hunker down and wait till this painful thing is over, that we can be patient, we can just hold ourselves down and be with this uncomfortable experience. But when we speak of the paramita of patience, of patient endurance, what that is pointing to is a quality of that is not just tolerating. True patience is not waiting. That we have our time of retreat now, a lot of formal sitting and being in a single position for long periods of time, an hour, a couple of hours at a stretch. So there's a lot of being with painful feeling. So any of us who've done much of that or any of that will realize that if you're waiting for the bell to ring, you're waiting for the clock to move round, you're waiting for the incense stick to burn down, and even though you see the smoke rising up from it, something in you is convinced that it's actually not getting any shorter. The smoke seems to be coming out, but it's staying the same length. The clock has been at 10:02 for the last half hour. Those kind of feelings. If we're waiting for it to be over, then that compounds our experience of suffering. We're We're creating tension and difficulty so that the patience, which is a paramita, which is a liberating quality, is not waiting. It's nothing to. It's letting go of time altogether. It's a complete abandonment that things can be any different than the way they are right now. It's not looking to a past or to a future. It's a complete release or relinquishment of anything other than this experience right now. And so that as the Buddha outlines this, just sort of points to this, you know, as the supreme practice for burning up unwholesome karma, the results of the painful results of action, and the result of birth, having a body, having a mind that is sensitive, that feels pleasure and pain. That quality of patience, a kind of open-heartedness, a readiness to be with without complaint, a kind of radical receptivity, that very openness, that readiness to be with this feeling in the body, this mood in the mind, this attitude, to be able to be open to it and recognize, well, good or bad, right or wrong, here it is, it's like this. Right now, this is the perception, this is the experience. It has this texture, this tone, this quality. And maybe it'll change, maybe it won't, maybe it'll get worse, maybe it'll be like this for the next 10,000 years. So what? Right now, this is it. And the heart can leave it alone and just simply be with it in an uncomplicated and clear, accepting way. So that there's no, even though it's maybe a painful or uncomfortable experience, there's no argument with it, there's no contention against it. So that it's maybe a bitter taste or a painful feeling, or maybe the mind is dull and sleepy or is grumbling about this or that. But even though it might be a painful feeling or a painful state, we begin to notice that if we just leave it alone, it's not pleasant, but it's absolutely not a problem. We don't add what the Buddha called the second arrow. The first arrow is the painful experience, but the second arrow is then grumbling, complaining, criticizing, negotiating, wheedling, maneuvering, moaning, criticizing. Just true patience, the paramita of Kanti, is that readiness to be with it, however it happens to form, to whatever shape it takes. And that very openness, that evenness of heart, is radically transforming. It cuts through that the mind which is always judging and picking and choosing and wanting the good and resenting the bad, trying to side with the pleasant and reject the painful, trying to have only the good, and trying to get rid of the bad. It's that a heart which recognizes the equality of all dhammas. Now sometimes it's the pleasant things are more difficult to endure than painful. We don't mind having a good struggle, but when things go well, or sometimes if we're praised, or things go well for us, we experience a lot of happiness and good fortune. Maybe that makes us even more unsettled and miserable because we feel we don't deserve it, or it's going to get taken away from us. So it's not necessarily just painful feelings that this is referring to. Patience is also to do with the whole spectrum of experience. Is that so? What this radical advice is pointing to in terms of practice is that the non-judgmental mind, truly establishing the attitude of wisdom, non-discriminative wisdom, that does not grab hold of the good and push away the bad, or grab hold of the pleasant and push away the painful. That there's a balancedness, that one is taking refuge in knowing, in awareness, in a balanced view, an open view, an unbiased view. And then seeing that the result of that is peace, is nirvana. You know, all those who know say nirvana is the supreme dhamma. That when there is that true clear vision, when there is that true openness of heart and impartiality, with pleasure and pain, success and failure, praise and criticism, gain and loss, happiness and unhappiness. When there, the more deeply and completely there is that impartiality, to exactly that proportion, there will be the quality of peace. And then the Buddha's making this statement those who know recognize that that peace is the best thing of all, of all qualities. Nibbana is the supreme Dhamma, that peace of heart, peace of mind, which comes through not clinging. That is the most precious, beautiful, liberating quality. That is the supreme Dhamma. And he, from there, he moves into saying, those who kill or harm others cannot be called those ordained ones who have become calmed. Nahi papajito parupagati samano hoti parang vihe tayanto. So he switches from that into a kind of the first reference to any kind of training, so that in training rule or in terms of conduct. So pointing to regardless of what your internal attitude is, you know, that there is absolutely no excuse. If you are one who is trying to realize the truth, you are committed to a path of awakening, and you're using the life of a renunciant, of a samana, one who is turning away from entanglement in the sense world in order to awaken to the unconditioned, that which is beyond or prior to the sense world, that is unentangled with the conditions, then there's absolutely no way that you could possibly act in a violent manner towards another living being. That is complete anathema to the spiritual path. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, the Buddha puts this out to the group of arahants. Also, it's there as the very first precept for the lay community. It's like the first principle above all others of the spiritual training is that of gentleness, of non-violence, ahimsa. And along with the teaching on patience, this is also a good fuel for contemplation. You know, that just as, you know, I was talking about patience and making my own kind of reflections, but also this is for each of us can look at it and explore and investigate these qualities for ourselves. So it's good to contemplate, well, why should that be? How come is that that's the case, that to take life, to kill, how come that is such a complete antithesis of the spiritual quality? How is it so that that's a complete going completely against the principle of Dhamma, the fundamental reality? How is that gesture of taking life? And it's worthy of investigation and to explore, because it's such a powerful and dominant presence within the Buddha's teaching. But you can see that it's primarily, well, I would say, that to take the life of another being in that very gesture, you're saying, you know, my life is more important than yours. So it's a basic gesture of selfishness and of aversion, of destructiveness, even for whatever intention one might be having. Still, there's an act of destructiveness, of harming, that is motivating that, and that intrinsically is bringing with it a whole slew of negative karmic results, and it kind of shuts the door of the heart to Dhamma. Then he makes this little synopsis of the path, and describes what is the absolute essence of teachings of all the Buddhas, which is extraordinarily simple in its own way. The not doing of all evils, the doing of what is wholly good, the cleansing of one's own heart, these are the teachings of all the Buddhas. So the not doing of all evils, so to refrain from the unwholesome, sabba papasa akaranam, kusala supasampada, the cultivation of the good, the cleansing of one's own heart, these are the teachings of all the Buddhas. So the not doing of the unwholesome, so restraining one's destructive or selfish urges with the precepts, the doing of what is wholly good, cultivating wholesome qualities, like, you know, loving kindness and wisdom, energy in the paramitas, all the wholesome qualities, the kusala dhammas, kusala kammas, the cleansing of one's own heart, the training of the heart in meditation, to purify the heart of all the hindrances and confusions, to train the mind, the heart in concentration and insight, to the point of realization. These are the teachings of all the Buddhas. And then he reiterates this, goes back to again talking about some of the basic themes of training. The not speaking of evil, the not hurting, anuppavado, anuppagato, being restrained according to the patimokkha, that's the monastic rule of training, patimokkhe cha sangvaro, knowing what is sufficient in taking food, matanyuta cha patasming, and having a secluded place for sleeping and sitting, pantancha sayanasanang, making efforts to practice in the pure heart, these are the teachings of all the Buddhas. Adichite cha ayogo etang bhutana sasananti. So to summarize the entire teaching of the Buddha, the entire Buddha sasana, the dispensation of the Buddha, first of all, he just does it in those simple three lines of the not doing evil, the cultivation of the good, the purification of the heart. This is the whole of the Buddha sasana. And then expanding it, yeah, in terms of physical action, not hurting, not speaking harm, not speaking evil. So speech and action, restrained according to the monastic rule. And then, interestingly enough, specifically because he's giving advice to arahants, knowing what is sufficient in taking food, that even to the enlightened you have to remind them that enough is enough. Having a secluded place for sleeping and sitting. So being mindful of how you are fitting in with the society around you, the world around you, making efforts to practice in the pure heart. These are the teachings of all the Buddhas. So this is all very simple, you know, practical, earthy advice, and a way of kind of a synopsis of trainings, just to be able to guide our lives towards the fulfillment of our potential. So to truly develop the patipati puja, the practice, the active devotion through Dhamma practice, it's applying these, you know, simple kind of pointers to undertake these basic standards of harmlessness, of guiding our speech to let our speech be something which is a beautiful presence in the world rather than a divisive or ugly presence. To look at our eating habits, and the basic standard that Ajahn Chah would always encourage is when you know that five more spoonfuls will be enough, then stop eating and finish off with water or some drink, and then that's the right amount for the day. And the doubting mind might think, well, how do I know what's enough? Or how do I know when five more spoonfuls is going to be enough? But it's very interesting that rather than having any kind of planned number of spoonfuls or calculating the needs of your calories per day, if we just pay attention, if we're mindful as we eat, then there's a very distinct moment, at least I find, there's a very distinct moment as you're eating, you finish a mouthful, and then, or even before you finish that mouthful, you eat something and you know, oh, that's it, that's enough. And you know, there's some intuition, some intuitive measure that's calculating out the number of calories that you're going to be needful of, or what the body requires and what you've taken in already. And the body knows, it has its own wisdom. So it's just the mindfulness to listen to that voice that says, enough. And then, you know, you put the spoon down. Similarly, you know, the advice about having a secluded place for sleeping and sitting, you know, just to if you want to sit and meditate, or you want to take a rest, just to be considering, well, is this the right place? Or am I going to be bothering somebody else? Or is this going to be in the way? Or is this going to look pretty uncouth, or stretching out and taking a nap right here? You know, is this going to be intrusive or unseemly in some way? So that these are just pointing to ways of restraint, of kind of curbing that kind of habitual outflowing tendency of following what I like and what I want, what's my habit and my preference, what's convenient for me. All of these different trainings are pointing to a kind of readiness to curb those outflowing habits, the urge to be impatient, to not tolerate the painful, to pursue and take hold of the good, to reject the bad, to act on selfish or greedy or destructive, deceitful impulses, to not bother cultivating the good, not make the effort to be generous or to be kindly, to engage wisdom. So it's encouraging that kind of self-control, encouraging a training, a turning inward, a looking within, in these simple, gentle, practical ways, so that the whole act of devotion in terms of practice is one of turning in, of a kind of internal reflection, looking at one's motivation, looking at one's mood, looking at what we're doing and how what the attitude is that we're bringing to what we do. And so that if we are seriously trying to develop the path, if we're seriously, we feel a devotion to the Triple Gem and we wish to embody that, then this is the fundamental gesture that we need to make. And this time of retreat is really encouraging that, a kind of developing our internality, looking at the inner world, developing that quality of control, of restraint, of patience, a readiness to forego our reactions of pursuing the pleasant, rejecting the painful, the urge to engage with another, to talk or to act or to do or to make something or fix something or even some kind of wholesome task around the monastery, we can find that just wanting to engage with something, just to burn some energy, do something, even though we can say, well, it's useful, we need to do this, but to consider, we're in retreat, do I really need to do this right now? Do I need to be sewing a whole new set of cushion covers or restructuring this particular storeroom or whatever? Just to be ready to restrain, to leave the sense world alone, to make that effort to let go. And this is really the greatest gesture of devotion, of reverence, is like, you know, feeling that urge to grab hold of, to the pull towards the sense world, and the recognizing that pull. And that pull can be loving it or hating it or having an opinion about it. Feeling that pull, knowing it, and then making the choice to not follow that. Patience of feeling that pressure and deciding not to be moved by it. That's the basic gesture of the heart. And then what we find when we are ready to not be swept along by that pull, when we learn to let go of it, and initially there's a resistance or an abrasion, the kind of our habits of attachment, identification are stretched, but shortly after there's this immense relief in the heart, and Nibbana is the supreme Dhamma. When the clinging stops, when that urge to identify and grab and opinionate or push away, when that wears down, what remains is peacefulness. When the clinging stops, there's peace. So that patience is not just leading us to more a kind of clamped jaw. But patience is the ready with that readiness to be with that urge to notice it, to be aware of it, to not follow it. As that arises and does its thing and then ceases, in its passing, in its cessation, there's tremendous peacefulness. The bliss of Nibbana is right there. It's right here. And certainly our conditioning is very strong. The pull towards the sense world is very strong, and there's a lot that is to be said for the protecting of the earth and looking after our things and caring for each other, and many aspects of the sense world seem to be quite innocent and fine and beautiful, and certainly there are all those dimensions, but what these teachings point to is that when we relate to the sense world as a fundamental reality, and we find our happiness in the beautiful aspects of the sense world, and then there we also find our suffering is in the ugly or painful aspects of the sense world. The heart is bashed around by happiness, unhappiness, gain and loss, praise and criticism. And it's through the loosening the grip on the sense world, understanding it, knowing it as it is, then the heart can really live in accord with it, can know it fully and completely, without confusion, without being bashed around by it. Ajahn Chah would say it's like the sense, the world of the senses is like a red-hot iron ball. No matter where you touch it, it's hot. It's hot on the top, it's hot on the sides, it's hot underneath. Wherever you touch it, it's hot. Therefore, don't grab it. So that in this this kind of training, what we're talking of is a knowing of the world, an understanding of the world, and a relating to the world without confusion, so that our lives, our speech, our action can be in accord with things, and no longer pulled around chaotically. We can be with life in the most straightforward, clear, and peaceful way. So that there's a way of relating to the world of senses, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, the world of form, the earth itself, our body, the people around us, the creatures of the world, the plants and animals, the minerals. There's a relating to them with a great sensitivity, but without any kind of grasping, without a kind of neediness or a possessiveness. There's an enjoyment. We can the heart enjoys the world of senses, just like now, the exquisite spring days. The big rainstorms have abated, and beautiful, bright, clear, sunny days, and all the manzanita bushes are flowering, and the air is so still and warm and bright. And now the night time has come, and the air is cooling off, and the moon is coming up. It's glorious and beautiful. But as soon as we try to make it, mine, or we want to, relate to it in a sort of possessive or grasping way, then even the most beautiful, exquisite conditions of the natural world become burdensome, painful to the heart. As the Buddha said, one who relishes the sense world relishes suffering, I say. So it's not the sense world that's a problem, it's the relishing. And that when we can learn how to recognize that urge, the sort of relishing, grasping, possessive habit, can know that, and be patient with that, learn to understand it, know what it is, and to train the heart not to be dominated by that, to let it just do its thing and fade, then we find a tremendous spaciousness and ease, a real peace that is incomparable. This is the peace of Nibbana, so that the heart is able to know the world, be with the sense world, to love the world without confusion, without attachment, without needing to get anything from it or have any opinion about it. It's able to simply be open, to know, and to let go, to allow the changes of life to come and go as they do. So I offer these words for reflection on the Marga Puja night, and we can I put out some copies of the Ovada Patimokkha at the back by the chanting book, so when we've finished then we can maybe pass those out and do the recitation together.